Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
It's about the fans and it's about the artists. That's the show. And the artists, we wanted to always have the artists come on and be themselves.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 185, a talk with Dr. Dre. Andre Dr. Dre Brown is best known for his time co-hosting Yo MTV Raps with Ed Lover, a job he held down from 1989 to 1995. He and Ed used their chemistry and comic sensibility to bring hip-hop and the artist who made it to a worldwide audience. But as you'll hear, there's much more to Dre than his time at MTV. He was a key part of the group Original Concept, one of Def Jam's early signings. He played an important role in the lives of some other early Def Jam acts, Public Enemy and the Beastie Boys. He's made movies, worked in radio, and done pretty much anything else you can imagine. Dre came back into the spotlight in the summer of 2016, when a New York Times article talked about his struggle with type 2 diabetes, which has cost him a toe and most of his sight. Along with longtime friend of the Cypher, Bill Adler, Dre visited us at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's the answer to the question, who's the man? Dr. Dre.
You can curse if you like.
I have to?
You don't have to.
No, Dick Gregory, look, you don't understand. When Dick Gregory curses you out, and then he backs down, you've lived in life long enough. It's a beautiful, if I was always wanted Richard Pryor or Red Fox to curse me out, and I can say, that happened to me. They got me. But
yeah.
Dick Gregory got me, and I'm so happy. You can't make me happier right now.
That's incredible. You were talking about that in the elevator. Can you tell me a little, you got a call from Dick Gregory?
Yeah, because Dick Gregory's working with my health issues and stuff.
Even with chicks begging me for Dick Gregory, a nigga known for getting rid of weight like Dick Gregory. I'm New York.
Legendary comedian and activist Dick Gregory, who has been vegetarian since 1969, has actually spent much of his time over the past 40 years lecturing about diet and alternative medicine. He claims that he defeated cancer in 2001 with, quote, a regimen of a variety of diet, vitamins, exercise, and modern devices not even known to the public. Gregory has helped people develop special diets to help with disease or drug dependency, including John Lennon. Of course, Dick is helping Dre with his diabetes.
When you call Dick Gregory, it's not like you got to call him in one time and he responds. You got to call him about 175 times and keep leaving the same message. So, I periodically kept calling. So, he calls me back. He goes, Dr. Dre? I said, yeah. What the fuck you want, man? I'm like, Dick? He says, Dick Gregory. Oh, Dick, what's going on? And I go, everything. He said, God damn it, I gave you fucking Dr. B's number. Dr. B's the herbalist who's working with us.
Mm-hmm.
And I told you to call Dr. B. I said, I did. He says, why the fuck are you calling me? I said, because your son told me to call you. Oh, he did? he said, you told him to tell him to call me to call you. Oh, yeah, all right, you're right. Okay. Well, right now, I'm fucking losing my mind. That goddamn election on Tuesday. This motherfucker's in here and people are calling me all over the goddamn world trying to figure out what the fuck. I'm like, Dick, I don't understand what you're talking about, but I'm with you. Okay. And he laughed and he said, okay, I'm going to give you Dr. B's number. Call Dr. B and then leave me alone about this shit. I said, okay. But your son told me to call. I'm just doing what you said.
Right.
You're right. And he's like, it's funny. It's like, once you throw it back, I'm like, I did what you told me to do. He goes, yeah, you're right. Call me anytime. It's all right. This is a lot of shit going on with this shit that happened on Tuesday, meaning the election.
Yeah. Is he ready to flee the country? Or?
I don't know anything, but I'm going to be honest with you. After I hung up, I fell out laughing. I couldn't stop laughing for like 10 minutes. I said, Dick Gregory just cursed me out, and I'm really happy about that. So, long story short, matter of fact, I called Dr. B, and I got a consultation call with him later today. But it was hysterical. Because the first number he gave me was like his answering service voicemail number.
Yeah.
So every time you call it, it gets the same thing. So you just leave a message. So when Dr. B called me back last night, he said, oh, yeah, Greg Dick called me and told me I ain't picking up the phone. I said, yeah, you're not. But he cursed me out. He said, yeah, I know. I messed up. And I just laugh. I think it's funny to me. It's like, I ain't take it personal. I just thought it was funny.
So there's so much to talk to you about, but I kind of wanted to start with Long Island, with Nassau County, with kind of the scene, the hip hop scene when you were growing up, because you had a crew going even before there were rap records, right, in the 70s.
Yeah, we did. But we would say the scene on Long Island, and I use the word just hip hop to always galvanize it with hip hop, because hip hop was the culture, because I was one of them 70s kids who used to, you know, steal his way up to the Bronx and see like Grandmaster Flash and Kool Herc and Afrika Bambaataa and the Zulu Nation perform and do stuff in the street. And that's where my inspirations came from, because when I was growing up, my father took me out on the subways and said, here's 3 tokens. I showed you how to get around. See you when you get home. And he leave. I was like, where are you going? I'll see you when you leave. And he left me. Left me in the Bronx one time. He left me in Brooklyn one time. And he left me in Staten Island one time. And I was like, damn, this is really long. Yeah. But he said, get your transfers. You know, he taught me all the things to do and showed me how to do it.
Yeah.
So I guess that was like the lesson. Then it was like, let me see you do it. So that's how I learned. So one of the funniest stories I have doing that, I went up, and I think I was going to see Flash in the Park and, you know, Furious 5, and they were performing. I was like, whoa, this and the other. And I'm standing there, and I'm getting into it. And then I hear Andre, and it's a familiar voice. I'm like, Andre? I'm like, this sounds like, hey, auntie. And I was like, she's like, what are you doing here? I said, where are we? She said, what are you doing? How did you get here? Where? She's like, you don't play with me. I said, oh my, I'm here. I must have got out the car. Mazel with you. She's like, no, she's not. Wait till I get home. She turned on her heels, and I was gone. So it was hysterical. But anyway, those were my influences. So I went back to Long Island. And I mean, I was intrigued by this because there was another gentleman who used to DJ at our local, I would call it community center, a place called Grand Street, where we went to kindergarten. But then it became this place where they used to throw parties all the time. His name was King Charles. And he'd come and he'd bring these speakers and this thing, and he would perform. I mean, with DJ Fest was like a performance, and he played these, and we'd all go crazy because we'd dance with the girls. He'd play the songs, and it was huge. I mean, between dance hall, reggae, you know, at the time, dance club music, slash, and there was really no rap music out yet, no real record. I mean, DJ Hollywood had a record out.
It's Holly girl, and I'm so glad that you came on down so we can spend some time together and maybe even mess around.
Woody Wood had a record out.
Music of the Woody Wood, I will definitely track the lot. You see, I'm a black Kojak and I'm better than Beretta. I'm a Casanova bound because I'm back to the hip.
But it wasn't like that kind of fervor.
Right.
First was the first time I ever heard it, and I fell in love with this man. If there's any man that I can say I fell in love when it came to music in this fashion, it would be him. The first time I heard Curtis Blow's Christmas rapping, he played that, and I stood on a dance floor and my eyes were wide up, mesmerized. I was going, wow, there's a guy rapping on a record. Wow. And it was just, ding, 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 ding.
Don't you give me all that jive about things you wrote before I was alive, cause this ain't 1823, ain't even 1970. Now I'm the guy named Curtis Blow, and Christmas is one thing I know. So every year, just about this time, I celebrate it with a rhyme.
The whole thing, I was like, wow, he's my hero. You know, I just... But before that, in the park, we had the Fatback Band came out with like King Tin the Third, and we were mesmerized by it. But it wasn't it was like the first real rap record on record.
You right. Grab your hands and you stomp your feet because you're listening to the sound of the show shot beat. I'm the K-I-N-G, the T-I-M, King Tin the Third, and I am him.
There's a long-running and ultimately unsettled argument over what should be considered the very first rap record. A strong case can be made for the 1979 song King Tim III, Personality Jock, by the Fatback Band with vocalist Tim Washington, as it came out a month before the Sugar Hill Gang's Rapper's Delight.
But it didn't have that street tinge the way it was. But then the summer was the summer of Good Times with Chic. Good Times came out, and we all fell in love with that bass line. I think half a year later, here comes the Sugar Hill Gang with Rapper's Delight.
The hip, you don't stop. Rock it out, baby, bubba to the boogity, bang, bang, the boogie to the boogity beat.
The world changed after that for us. So we were always DJing, but that galvanized rap music and trying to find rap records. Because then slowly but surely, they started coming up. But we always had rappers come up and be a part of that. And the reason we got into, honestly, we got into DJing, we wanted to talk to girls. Simple. You go to parties, you got no play. The DJ, the girls would be hanging on them. Can you play this record? Can you do that? It was like, man, I should do that too. So my father, don't forget, my sister was graduating college. My brother was graduating high school. I was graduating junior high. And my father went out and bought four stereos for the house. Got my sister one, my brother one, got me one. And then he bought one for the house. I took my father's turntable and took it with my turntable that I was supposed to get, because I didn't get my stereo right away because I had an attitude problem. Because, you know, when you're that age, you have an attitude problem with your father. So he said he's not giving me my stereo. So I used to take his thing. And then my brother showed me how to go between turntables without a mixer. This was before I ever knew what a mixer was. And you'd click from A channel to B channel, A channel to B channel. And he'd make these tapes, and it always sounded so cool. And he always had these records. And every time I went to borrow a record, he would, no, you can't borrow my records. So we'd leave, and I'd borrow the records anyway. So I started to learn to master that switch. And I'll never forget, I broke his switch, and I kind of glued it and acted like I didn't do it. And my brother got there one time, he clicked, and he said, it's not working anymore. And my father had to take it back to Lafayette to get the switch fixed. And I forget that. And that started intriguing me more and more about building a system. Mm. And my father had these bigger speakers called these Lafayette 2001 speakers at the time. And I thought those were like the most amazing things. They were huge. And I just started getting more fascinated with music, because I always loved music. I was just talking about this last night. Matter of fact, we were talking about different radio stations. And when BLS came around, and before there was a WBLS, I always used to be a 77 WABC guy, because I just liked the way they played music. And it was always popular hit music and stuff like that. And I was fascinated with, you know, every hit song that came out.
When I get that dude back with that horn, man, I can dig that. I like that.
The only sounds you'll hear on 77 WABC now are Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and Trump Train sound effects.
There was WWRL at the time, too, but you could barely get where I was in Long Island. It was staticky. So, you know, you get it, you may get it, you get it, you may get it.
From WWRL, the server dealing the feeling at 251, inside your mind with Skull Snaps.
And I always wanted to be involved in that, trying to find a way to be involved with the music. And because there was no DJing or rap records or stuff like that at that time. So I was always immersed in the music.
Right. How'd you end up at Adelphi?
A very large woman with a giant posterior and a very special pair of lips, should I say. That's how I went down to Adelphi University. My father passed away when I was 17. Mm-hmm. And I was an athlete and I played football. So I always wanted to go to the University of Southern California. I just was my fantasy. I just enjoyed, I mean, excuse the expression, between O.J. Simpson, Anthony Davis, and Marcus Allen. Mm. You know, that's what I saw. I said, that's where I want to go play. So I was getting, we just won a championship in Westbury, our team, and I played nose guard and I played running back. And I was big, fast, and I said, I'm going to go out there. And I said, if I can't get a scholarship, I'm going to go out there and do a walk-on. So right. I was planning my life in that fashion. And then we found out my father got sick. And as he was passing away from cancer, my plans changed. So friends of mine told me to go to NASA. Don't sit around and do nothing. Go to school. Your father would want that. And, you know, that was my last words to my father. My father said to me is to study hard. So I went to NASA, and that's what I did. I immersed myself in my education. And I didn't know if I wanted to do pre-med or pre-law, so I took both. That's just what, you know, I did. And I went to all these different freaking hours of labs and all that stuff. And I thought that's a normal school thing. And I got immersed into the African-American studies program. And I started studying every part of it, unleashing a world of knowledge that I kind of had, but expanding upon it. And I really liked it. I enjoyed English class. And then I started taking classes where people looking at me like I was crazy. I went and started taking women's classes. People said, why would you take women's classes? Why would you go there? I said, I like women. They may teach me something I don't know. So the fun part about going to NASA was I would go in this class. First of all, there was like a tenth of a percent of African-American people going to those classes. So every class I went to, that was the first culture shock I had, where I was the only black kid in a class. Mm-hmm. So I'd go into this woman's class, and it'd be like 50 women and two guys, one white guy and me. And I would always sit in the front thinking, you know, I'm going to get these students. And the teacher, I'll never forget, the teacher came out. She said, now this is what I like. And I'm like, what? She said, look at this man right here, this young man. He's a genius. And I'm going,
What you talking about?
She's like, me. He's smart enough to come here to be educated on what we're going to talk about. And it was like women's issues. And I'm thinking we're going to, you know, psychological, the practicality. When she starts talking about gynecological things and this and that, I'm like, yeah, I kind of wanted to know this, but maybe this is not where I need to sit. But at the end, by the end of the semester, everyone, all the women, they love me because I would ask the questions that they wanted to ask and they'd ask questions. It was a great place to learn. Right. So while going there, I excelled very well, and I got on the dean's list. Being on the dean's list, one of my professors said, I got a scholarship to Cortland for you. Cortland University's Ivy League. You know, you deserve it. You should go. And I got a scholarship to Adelphi University. I was dating a young lady who was just graduating high school at the time, very enamored, and she got a scholarship to Adelphi, and she was going to leave and move into the dorms. Well, you know, unfortunately, I have to say fortunately, because if I never went to Adelphi, I would have never met the people I met. I would have never done the radio I did.
Right.
So I chose Adelphi. Everyone was like, you got a free ride to Cortland. What's wrong with you? I said, well, no, Ma, I don't want to leave you here by yourself, because I have two other older siblings and a stepbrother. I really didn't want to leave my mother like that just to disappear. Because, I want, like I said, my goal was to go to USC and play football. That's what was all in my head, play right. football. But I kind of dropped that after my father died because he said, study hard. So that's what I did. So I went to Adelphi. And then when I went to Adelphi, I took a class called African American Music 1. And the professor's name was Andre Strobert, Professor Andre Strobert. And in that class was a gentleman by the name of Bill Stephanie, Carlton Ridenour, professionally known as Chuck D, Harold McGregor, also known as Harry Allen, and myself. Yo!
Bill Stephanie is a former Def Jam executive who has played a key role in Public Enemy's career since the beginning. He was one of the key voices in convincing Public Enemy to sign to Def Jam in the first place, and he produced and played on the group's debut album, Yo Bum Rush the Show. He also co-founded the Soul label with fellow Bomb Squad member Hank Shockley. Chuck D is, well, Chuck D, and Harry Allen served as Public Enemy's publicist, or as they preferred to put it, their media assassin.
Sitting in that class, you know, and getting to know everybody and talking about different musics and stuff like that, I would always go to school. I had on a tie and a shirt and a sweater vest and the whole thing. Even when Bill Adler met me the first time, I had her, you know, I was dressed like, and they used to go, this guy DJs and those, and he's coming to school. What's wrong with you? And they said, man, so, you know, cause, you know, finally, you know, you're talking, the semester's going by. And Bill said, you know, have you ever seen the radio station here? I said, no, I didn't know you guys had a radio station. So he brought me up to the radio station. I had heard about BAU. But I didn't know BAU was on campus there like that. So he took me up there and introduced me to people. He said, hey, man, you go come by my show Monday nights and check this out. So I did. And I just went Google Gaga. I was always looking for a radio station. I was loving it. Love what Bill was doing on the air. I said, this is amazing.
Your hands in the air. I wait from like you just don't care. Now, y'all want to chill wheel in a new Seville. So I'm about to say, Mr. Bill.
Mr. Bill.
Mr. Bill.
Mr. Bill.
And this is, again, this is all premature to heavy, a lot of rap records being produced and actually being put on wax.
Right.
So everything they did on tapes, or they had the recordings from local groups. And I just became intrigued by it. Because the funny thing is, like, I heard about it, I heard it, but I never could put the two things together. So when I met Chuck and they told me they were with this group called Spectrum, now me being in my group called The Concept, we had an issue with a group named Spectrum. We didn't realize there were two Spectrums.
Oh.
There was Spectrum City, which was Spectrum
which was
that
Chuck
they were, which was Chuck.
Yeah.
Then there was this other thing called Spectrum 2. And these guys, because our goal being those kind of DJs, you don't want to DJ at the college parties everywhere. This guy blocked us out of a college that he had. So we were like, we're going to get in here. And every time we would start to get inroads, he would block us and do the party. So we got pissed. Henceforth, so when I met Chuck, I was like, so here I met the guy that's been blocking me all this time. So, you know, you got
that real
eye, and he's giving you that other eye. And I'm going, yeah. So I finally meet Hank Shockley, and I met Keith. And I keep forgetting, I had met Keith before, but never made the connection. Mm-hmm. Because Chuck was the only one who used to wear the Spectrum jacket. And then I saw Keith put on. I told my guy, T-Money, I said, T, we got to get these motherfuckers. We're going to get these motherfuckers. Let's get down and post. We talk, so, you know, you get down, you start having a conversation. And we start talking. I said, yeah, man, so why don't y'all let us, you know, get down, see the post? You know we're good. And you said, what are you talking about? He said, yeah, man, they say Spectrum. He said, nah, man, it's that dude. He hijacked our name. I said, what? He said, yeah, that's and I don't want to say his name because I'd be indiscreet.
Yeah.
Anyway, long story short, we said, we got the same problem. I said, yeah, we need to go over there and stomp him out.
So what we did is that's how we got together. We went over there, not to stomp him out, but we went over there to fight to get our thing. And so we started to realize you have to connect with the Greek clubs and stuff like that to try to get shows. But he always blocked because there was this one club there at CW Post always through the parties. And he was a member. So you're not going to break that. So we said, well, so if we can't beat him, I mean, if we can't join them, we're going to beat them.
Yeah.
So we, you know, like Keith Shockley and Spectrum City, they were throwing parties on one side. I was on the other side because Westbury and Roosevelt, it's like a division is Hempstead. Mm-hmm. And we were on one side of Hempstead. We were more on the North Shore. They were more on the mid to South Shore. And we, you know, I've been to their parties like, wow, this is really cool. And we said, we were doing what we were doing. And they were like, wow, you know, you guys had a vision and you're doing stuff over here. No, nobody really knew. So when we hooked up together, we started hanging out. You know, they introduced me to the Intermetro record pool out here, and I joined up with them, and we used to go back and forth, and it was like we just created this synergy using the base of doing BAU. And eventually when Bill decided when he was graduating, he was leaving, he passed the show over to me.
The operating room?
Which was the operating room.
Yo, yeah. Cuz, I'm one of the most ill and B-boys, cuz, and you're listening to the operating room with Dr. Dre on WBAU 90.3 FM.
Yo, Chuck, what's the moves, man?
I want them to know that we have a new record coming out called Watch My 9mm Go Bang! We're gonna preview it tonight here, right? Definitely. That's what time is. You see this gold gun on my neck? It's German Luger.
Yeah.
KRS-One, Scott LaRock will be back with you right after the bridge is over, right here. 90.3 FM, WBAU.
They were always doing the Super Spectrum Mix Hour on one half on a Saturday night. So I would have to come in and host, not host, but just engineer and slash host that. And then eventually they decided to let Flavor be the host of the first hour of that.
Welcome to the MC Flavor Show. Spam, what's up? It's my sister, y'all on the phone with me. What's up? Hold up a minute.
My name is Flavor.
And then the music part would come in the second part. So Flavor and I would go at each other sitting there, and they all thought that was hysterical. They said, you guys need to have a show. You guys are just crazy together. And because it was, we snapped on each other all the time. Mm-hmm. I would say our greatest, if you want to talk about a White House, our greatest White House was called White Castle in West Hempstead. That's where we always got together after the shows. And everybody, no one had money, so we all threw money in a pot and said, okay, we can get these many burgers and we'll split them, and then we can get these many drinks and everybody pass it around, but this is what we can do. Because nobody had money. This is what you do. You're in college. You know.
This is the funny thing about that is I read you said that Chuck was right there with everyone as far as like snapping on people.
He's
which,
right
you
there.
Know, four years later, he's like the spokesman for Black America and people see him as super serious and he sort of can't do that in public anymore.
Yes, he did, because he did it on Yo MTV Raps, and we got the biggest backlash about that. And someone had said to me, how dare you joke with Chuck D? I said, are you high?
I've been joking with Chuck D.
First of all, his name is Chucky D from where I went to school. He's respectful. We did this every Monday night. So these jokes, that's why you're not getting the jokes.
Right.
But if Flavor came on and Flavor and I would go out, everybody would be exalted and cracking up. Right. So I just have to temper it. But then Chuck said, yo, forget that. Man, we're going to do what we got to do, Dre. Whatever the hell. Yeah. So that's how all those things kind of came together. Because of I tell my son these stories about us running out in the middle of the night, hanging posters up on telephone poles in deep freezing weather. I tell my son about we used to do parties and pack them in the middle thing. One of the biggest things I ever did, and Hank and I were so impressed, I did a thing called Rap Convention at Nassau Community College. And no one thought, we were like, Dre, it's not going to work. But I made 1,000 posters. We all hung them up everywhere. And the thing, we packed 10,000 people at the student union. And everyone was like, how did you do this? I said, because everybody wanted to see this. That's why I said, it wasn't even using the word hip hop yet. We were just using rap this, rap that, rap that. But we would do park jams. We would do everywhere from Christian halls and you name it. Where if we can get in there, we threw a party there and we packed it. We did one of the craziest parties we ever did was at the old Hempstead movie theater with no heat in the deep freeze on the stage. And we're sitting there going, trying to play records. You know it had to be cold when the equipment's going, nah, I'm out. This is cold for me. And, you know, equipment likes cold, but it was like, nah. Yeah. We're in sub-zero temperatures and people are coming in and partying. It's like, yo, what are y'all are crazy? You got their big, giant coats on and they're trying to hang out and party because it was that cold. So we did so much of that stuff. And then we even went out of state. We did stuff in Philly. We did stuff in Connecticut. We went everywhere because we always were expanding upon and seeing what was going on. At that time, you know, groups like Run DMC came through and got a chance to interview them and be a part of them when they came out with It's Like That and Sucker MCs.
The Bill Stefani interview Dre is referring to here is Run DMC's first interview ever.
Created a relationship with them. Davey D from Davey DMX, he made records, got it, created one of my longest friendships in this business is with Davey D, a great, great buddy of mine, as well as tons of other groups. And then we also are budding and playing all this music that we're actually creating, which is kind of, a lot of stuff that we were playing, doing for the radio station was like a gag. Even like for Original Concept, when we did Knowledge Me was a radio station promo. It was a gag song. We were, you know, promoting the station. And it became this phenomenon of speech of what was going on because we were talking like that when we were joking around doing parties.
Right. But
then we put it, T-Money and I put it to a record. I made the music. We put it together. My man E-Mac played the bass line and who knew?
Yo, you know, rest in your pocket, man.
And what'd he say to you, man?
You know what he said to me, man?
No, what'd he say to you, man?
He said, knowledge me of me.
So I took it up. Now, in fact, I was going back and forth dealing with Rick Rubin from Def Jam, and Def Jam was a young budding company at the time.
I was going
to
ask how Def Jam sort of got into the mix of all this.
Well, Bill introduced me to Rick, and I kind of knew Rick because I knew a friend named Peter Kuberschmidt who lived in Long Beach. And Rick Rubin, who originally is from Long Beach, I kind of knew him like through somebody, but didn't know him. And then when we finally got together, and I said, yeah, you know, Peter, he said, yeah, I said, I heard about you. And then we go back and forth. He said, yeah, I heard about your radio station. So he was just doing pre-licensed to Ill Beastie Boy stuff. And I said, well, bring him out. I'll interview him. Really? They're going to come from the city and go to Long Island. I said, why not? I said, it's right there. The train station's right there. I said, matter of fact, I'll pick him up in my car. And I had my mother's 78 Deuce and a Quarter with a busted headlight. got put him in the car. Adam Yao, I think Mike Diamond, Adam Horowitz got in the car. T-Money, we all packed in. They're like, whoa, this is a big-ass car. Yeah, it's a huge car. Those cars, they don't make cars like that anymore.
Right.
You can put 25 people in that car, and there's still room. Went out there, actually picked them up, drove them back to BAU, did the interview. We hung out there. Like, wow, you really do this. And they saw what we were doing. They caught the vibe, so they heard all these other songs, and they went back and told Rick. And Rick calls me. He says, yo, Dre, man, I heard, you know, you playing this and this. Could you bring something to me? I said, sure, why not? So Run had told him about Knowledge Me and Can You Feel It. Which was at that time was called It Was Great to Be Here. And I played it for him and he went crazy. He said, this is incredible. You got to be on Def Jam. So he gave me a contract and I said, sure. We were still hustling around doing parties on the island. Chuck and Hank and Keith and the company had a sour taste about doing music because they did a Spectrum City record called Lies and Check Out the Radio.
They were all the people gonna let it out loose. Look out, what if people here comes the truth? Lies. Got to check out the radio.
We thought it was great. The politics of putting records on radio did them in. They were pissed off about that. And that was on Vanguard Records, I believe. So I was trying to convince them while we were out at Entourage, which was Twilight's in Bayshore. Dude, this is crazy. Let's get in this record thing. I just signed to Def Jam. Let's do this. We'll work the whole thing. No, Dre, I don't want to do that. I want to do that. So I was in the studio when we finished doing Knowledge Me, and I'm hanging out with Running Them and Rick while they were doing Raising Hell. And they Run says, Dre, could you come up with a song like for us, you know, with a very black heavy theme, you know? I said, sure. So I sat there and said, no, do it right now. Really? So I sit down, get on the drum machine, T-Money's there, and we start pounding out a beat. I said, you like this beat? Love this beat. Now write it up. I said, write what up? I thought you wanted to write the song. No, right, get the words. So I run back, get to my guy, Rapper G. He sits down, he starts penning the song, Proud to Be Black. We put it together. Here you go. Okay, let's record it. Where am I going? No, you do it right now. So Rick, Jay, myself, Run, they go in. G already laid it down, and they do it exactly how he laid it out on the thing. Henceforth, the song Proud to Be Black on Raising Hell.
Yeah.
You still have the demo anywhere?
No. 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 I used to, but no.
Yeah. Now.
Long story short, so Rick's talking to me and he's saying, yo, I can't go back on the road. I'm, you know, getting busy with this deal because they just started getting a CBS deal. So now we're all on CBS, Def Jam. We're all excited. And he says, why don't you DJ for the Beastie Boys? And I said, what? I already got original concept. I got to do both. Yeah, you can do it. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. It's okay. It's okay. I said, all right. I end up being a DJ for a year and a half.
Wow.
Go out on the Raising Hell tour with them. Record with them, license the ill stuff. They record on original concept straight out the basement of Cooley High. Matter of fact, it's Mike D's on She Got a Mustache.
Mustache, yeah.
Yeah, Mike D's on that song. So that's how it started. So while we're riding in tour buses back and forth, I'm playing BAU tapes. Rick hears the tape with Public Enemy number one on it. Well, they hear it. So they're talking about, yo, you got to bring this into Rick. Got to bring this into Rick. So I bring it into Rick. Russell's sleeping on the mattress. Rick is here. I play in Public Enemy. He loses his mind. He says, this is incredible. I give me a copy of this. So I gave him a copy. Play it for Russell. Russell goes, what is all this noise? Takes the tape and throws it out the window. I'm like, dude, what's wrong with you? Man, that's noise. Man, ain't nobody we're listening to that crap. Out the window it went. Getting the negotiations with Rick about getting Chuck and him signed. Chuck and him don't want to sign.
Right.
So Bill's like trying to convince them to sign. Eventually, everybody convinces them. They decide to sign. Henceforth, Public Enemy now on Def Jam.
Right.
That's how it happened. So it's a fun story.
Yeah, that's amazing. With the original concept album, I was going to ask because we were talking about Rick, there's a lot of guitar on that. Johnny was a gangster. Is that him playing it?
No. That's a lot of innovation for me. I wrote the song I wrote the song Pump That Bass in the back of the tour bus while I was on License to Ill.
Pump That Bass.
When we had little breaks, I would come back, go to the studio, and keep filling in. The two studios I used Ian London out in Long Island, out in Bayshore, and Kenny Wallace, and I forgot the young man who played a lot of the guitar on that song. Mm-hmm. He did that guitar riff, and then I went back with Steve Vai.
Steve Vai was a recording engineer who started his career working with acts like Steely Dan and Ricky Lee Jones. He teamed up with Rick Rubin in the mid-1980s and worked on many early Def Jam releases by LL Cool J, Jimmy Spicer, Jazzy J, Slayer, and the Beastie Boys, as well as projects by Run DMC, Heavy D and the Boys, Stetsasonic, and more.
And I remember, because I had to get back on the road, it took me 36 hours to edit with Steve at Pump That Bass.
Wow.
And they were all like, how did you think of this? I said, I'd always thought of something crazy like this. Wow. If I ever did like an extended version, you'd go crazy. But all the guitar stuff and guitar riffs, like Mike Saxon played stuff on Pump That Bass. Mm-hmm. The other young man, he played on Johnny Was a Gangster. And a lot of stuff, we had influences back and forth. Because one thing about how Rick and the Beasties and I, we came across, they were like in shock that I really knew all the AC/DC and Led Zeppelin songs. And then when they saw my record collection, they were like, he really has that many records. Like, whoa. And they were like, why would you get that? I said, I'm a kid from Long Island. What do you think I listen
right,
to? I DJ from different places. So I need certain records. It just works that way.
Right.
So they were like always in shock. So when we took Cashmere and used it for Total Confusion, mm-hmm. They were like, why are you using Cashmere? Well, let the sun beat down upon my face. I said, because I know Cashmere.
Right.
What are you talking about?
Same thing with Dream On, right?
Yeah, you it's use like, that too. I use Dream On for Prejudice. Every time that I look in the mirror, all these lines in my face getting clearer. The past is gone. White on like black, I ran on like a rat. That's the way it is, but it should not be like that.
You're a negative man with a negative way of thinking. That's why your life's stinking like a ship is sinking. Come to think
we like that song.
Right.
You know, it was, there was something amazing in that. Even when Walk This Way was done, that was from an influence from a guy that Rick grew up with named Ray Amico out in Long Beach, because he had done... used Walk This Way, but he was rhyming on it and sent it in to Rick. And then Rick, I guess, and Run Them had the forethought to just let's redo it as a cover.
One of the things about original concept that I found fascinating, with the first single, you guys had a number one hit in Miami and had no idea until you got there. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, we had a number one hit in Miami. And when we first flew down there, well, first we had a number one hit in San Francisco and Oakland.
Also with Can You Feel It?
With Can You Feel It and Knowledge Me. And we flew, I'll never forget, that was the greatest gig we never played. We flew out there, got to the airport, got off the plane, and we were waiting for the promoter to pick us up. And nobody picked us up. It was, and this was before cell phones. And our road manager, who was supposed to have the number, lost the number to call the guy. And we're sitting there on the conveyor belt all night long. And everybody's going, Dre, this was stupid. This was stupid. I said, dude, how do I know this is going to happen? And didn't know who to call. And I guess they couldn't know how to find us. And there was like eight of us. And we're sitting around going, So I'll never forget. It was like the greatest gig we never played. So we sat there and we fell asleep on the conveyor belts. And had to get up the next day and got on the plane and went home. And the guy's calling, trying to curse us out. And they went and checked at the airport. They said, they were here. They were here all night long. Where were y'all?
Right.
And they were like, we're so sorry. I said, I don't care. Pay me. So then the next call came due to Miami, the James L. Knight Center. And we went down there. And I'll never forget that. That's the first time I ever met Two Live Crew. I heard about them. But first time I met Luke and the Two Live Crew, because they opened for us. And we didn't know what the hell to do. We did this song called Can You Feel It that has no vocals. What the hell are we going to do, run around? We don't dance. We're DJs. We don't give a shit. And then we're going to do Knowledge Me, which is not like a traditional song where you can sit down and, you know, follow along. Do it.
Right. It's more you're just kind of shit-talking through the whole song thing. Yeah.
We get down there, and the reaction we got, well, we're doing the radio interviews and going there, and people are going crazy. The lights are going crazy. And they're playing the song, and the guys go, look outside, look outside. And I'm like, well, outside where? There's people dancing in the street, too. We're like, whoa. This is supposed to be working.
Yeah.
Go to the James L. Knight Center to perform, and Luke and them come out. And I think that's when they were doing Thota D or Thota P. One of the Thos. They were throwing something. And we met Luke, and we were talking to Luke. And it's the first time we saw, like, the girls. Mm-hmm. And that, we were like, what? And I always attribute this to the genius of T-Money's father, Mr. Paul Kelsey, who told us in our days of DJing, he said, y'all need to get you some go-go dancers. And we're like, get us some what? Get you some go-go dancers. Have them dancers dance on them speakers. And the people will come to you. We're like, we can't do that. No girls are going to want to come dance for us on some speakers.
Right.
Went down to Miami. Changed our thinking process. And watching Luke, we were like, what? And they were all dying to watch us perform. And we were nervous. And this was before Rapper G actually came on and started rhyming on records with us.
Mm-hmm.
But we knew Rapper G because I was producing him with his group, What It Be 3 MCs. So I was like, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And T and I look at each other, and Easy, he's like, I don't give a shit. I just play the records. Y'all get out there and do what you got to do. So we figure out, this is what we're going to do. Let's make this work. So we went out to Can You Feel It, and we made up some fun stuff in between. Being DJs, you know how to do call and response, and the people went crazy. And Luke's like, yo, this is the shit. This is the shit. This is the shit. Then we did Knowledge Me, and it's like, they were transfixed by every word we said. And we didn't know what we were saying because we weren't doing the song.
Right.
We were making shit up about Miami as we did it. As long as we got to Knowledge Me a bit, didn't matter. We just made it up.
Yeah. Amazing.
And then I remember coming back to Bill Adler when he was working at Rush. And I think it was Tony Rome.
In that home, I got a call from Tony Rome. The FBI was tapping my telephone.
Tony Rome was Curtis Blow's childhood best friend and an early employee of Def Jam. He became LL Cool J's road manager and the national director of Def Jam's historic 1987 tour.
Tony Rome ran up to me and he said, yo, man, do you know how fucking crazy that Knowledge Me shit is in L.A.? I said, what are you talking about? He said, they're going crazy out there for this song. Do you know? And I'm like, no, I don't live in L.A. He said, no, it's like this huge hit out there. Because it spoke to all the gangs and the yokas, yo. That's the way they, we didn't know. We did what we did for was over here. Went out there and did a show. Crazy. It was, we did Knowledge Me. And then this is when we didn't understand the whole gang culture from them. And it just was like, wow. That's when we understood when we did a song and music, we have to understand that it's not playing in Long Island. These things play around the world.
Right.
And, you know, you're getting certain attention that you don't understand. And these songs get certain responses.
Yeah.
So that was kind of like that Miami thing was the biggest thing. And Luke and I became the best of friends from that moment on for a long time. Still one of my best friends. We used to throw birthday parties always together.
Oh, can't imagine what a Luke Campbell birthday party is like.
Let's see. We got shut down in Detroit one time. I bought Chuck and I bought Run. And we did Run DMC and Public Enemy songs on stage. The place was beyond packed, unannounced. They come on the stage and we're doing crazy stuff together. And people are losing their minds. That's what a Dr. Dre and Luke birthday party was like. Everywhere we threw one in New York City, we got shut down like within an hour because the people couldn't get in. And everybody was thinking all the Luke dances, we advertised all the Luke dances, we're gonna have a Luke dancer contest there. Couldn't get anybody else in there. It got shut down. Shut down.
I wanted to ask about one kind of, you know, you talked about the Raising Hell tour. There was one particular moment in that I just kind of wanted you to talk about, which is the Beasties had a little bit of an incident when they performed at the Apollo.
Yes, I was there. I'm on the Run DMC videotape when Jam Master Jay is playing the instrumental to Knowledge Me because they're doing Together Forever because it didn't have an instrumental. Mm-hmm. So that's what it was. And I'll talk about that little pickup from Rick later. Yeah, we were on the stage, the Beasties, and Holdin' Out Hit It was becoming a hit. Mm-hmm. And they were doing Slow and Low and they were doing what we all would just do naturally. And they were at the Apollo and they were very psyched to be at the Apollo. So I'll never forget, we were on the tour bus, they were upstairs, we were all super psyched, got down to the sound check, everything was great. Go out there and do it. Jumping on the stage, MCA, it wasn't Yacht, it was definitely Ad-Rock. Never forget. He runs out on stage, you know, throw your hands in there. So he says it and it was like, you could hear a pin drop. He says, all you niggas throw your hands in the air. And even I'm up there on the booth going, did he just say that? Normally, I wouldn't care. And I really didn't kind of care because everybody before us was saying that. Everybody there, you know, it was just everybody was there doing it. They did it. And it was like the audience, everybody was like, yeah, what did he just say? And he looked and he like became an ice popsicle right there on the stage. He just froze like a deer in headlights. And he looked to his left and looked, and Yacht was like, not me. Mike Diamond was gone off the stage. I'm sitting out there and I'm going, okay, how do I cover this up? And he exits because he's feeling all the stares, everything. Yacht kind of does a little something, eases to the stage. Now everybody's staring at me, and I'm going, ticka, ticka, doo, hold it now, ticka, ticka, hold it now, yeah. And I'm dancing like I can't hear anything. And I go, yeah, no, everybody's gone. So I just kind of creep off the stage, walk to the back. They're gone. No, I'm stage in the back. And they're going, yo, Trey, yeah, man, yeah, I like, they're cool, man, but what was that shit about, you know, niggas? I said, well, did somebody say niggas? I heard niggas all night long. What are you talking about? Yeah, no. One of them white boys said niggas. I said, I didn't hear that. And I was on the stage. What are you speaking? I mean, I knew I heard it.
Right.
And I'm going, I don't know what you're... Well, where'd they go, man? Because we just want to talk to them. I said, I don't really know. Because I had to get the record. You know, I'm using every excuse in the book. Talking about, if I'm going to get my ass kicked tonight, I'm getting my shit. I'm putting it on my shoulder. And he's like, I'm out. I'm like, dude. Okay, so I'm here by myself. They were in the tour bus in the back, door locked. Not letting anybody on the bus. So I'm going to the bus, open the goddamn door. Open the goddamn door. I walk in, I said, who said, all y'all niggas throw your hands in the air? And nobody wants to admit to it. I said, who said that? I said, let me tell you something. I don't care. I'm a little different. We're in Harlem at the Apollo, and there's a lot of niggas here. You shouldn't be saying that yet. We're not there yet. We're trying to get there. It's not a good idea. And he's like, Dre, it just came. He was like, I just was so calm. I know. I said, that would be equivalent to me saying in the middle of Madison Square Garden with a packed house full of white people, okay, you crackers. It wouldn't play well. It'd be one of those things, I'd understand the silence.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's before you do something crazy like that and leave the black guy sitting up there, talk to me about it, okay? Give me a heads up. Let me know. Because I could easily leave a record going and be out like y'all was out.
Right.
That's what happened.
So I wanted to move into TV for a minute. Obviously, your time at Yo, Pete Doherty was the guy who discovered you, right? God bless the dead. Hold it now.
Peter Doherty was the co-creator of Yo MTV Rap, advocating for a rap show on MTV years before Yo's 1988 premiere and developing the show's pilot along with Ted Demme. Doherty moved to London in 1990 and played a variety of roles at MTV Europe for 15 years. He also directed the Beastie Boys video for Hold It Now, Hit It. Doherty passed away in October 2015 of a heart attack.
My man.
This guy discovered you, right?
Yes and no, because Pete was hanging out with me with the Beasties. That's how I knew Pete.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had this relationship, and he was always around, and we were always talking. And I never really knew who Pete was. He just was always the Irish guy drunk hanging out with us. So everybody used to hang out with us and be drunk. So it was normal. I was like, okay, right. By the way, guy drinking. So we do. What's happening?
Right.
So I left the tour, and I was DJing some loft parties in the city. And I guess Peter found out Flyer was out, and I was DJing. He comes up to me, and I'm, you know, hanging out, doing my thing. And he goes, hey. Hey, I said, oh, hey, what's up? Yo, my man, what's that? Hey. He goes, you know, and he's asking me what happened. I'm telling him what happened with us with the Beasties. And he goes, yeah, I kind of figured that was going to happen though on y'all. And he said, we're coming up with this show. Can you come to MTV? I want to talk to you about it. I'm going, really? And he whips out his card, and I'm seeing MTV. And he has this shamrock on his card, Peter Doherty. I'm like, I guess he works for MTV. That's nice. Put it in my pocket. Don't think two more seconds about it. He said, you know, you got a card? And I'm pulling out my 3-5 card. I said, yeah, call me at this number and this number. Here's my card. And I get home the next day and he calls. And he's like, hey, Dre, what's going on? I said, who's this? It's Peter Doherty. Look at my pocket. Oh, yeah, MTV dude. What's going on? What's happening? Dude, are you free? What day are you free? Can you come in? I want to talk to you about something on MTV. I said, sure, why not? I'll come in. So I go in. First of all, I'm going MTV.
Right.
This is, I mean, them playing Michael Jackson was a phenomenon. And then playing Run DMC was like a phenomenon. So here I'm going into MTV going, what do they want with me? Right. This is ridiculous. I go and he sits down and he tells me about, yeah, we're thinking about doing this show called Yo MTV Raps and blah, 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 blah. I say, really? Yo MTV Raps sounds kind of interesting. Yeah, we're going to shoot this pilot and, you know, out in Nassau. You should come and hang out. And I'm like, yeah, really? I don't feel like it was a Def Jam tour at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So Run DMC was the original
host. Was the show they hosted, the pilot. Yeah.
Yes, it was the debut, the pilot show of Yo MTV Raps.
Yes, yes, yes. Yo, what's up? I'm Jam Master Jay, this is Run DMC, and welcome to Yo MTV Raps Show.
Yo, we get ready to do an hour of new videos right here on MTV. We got the motherfucking crowd in the house, right?
Yo, check this out. We got interviews with the hottest rap stars on the face of the earth, you know what I'm saying? All the rap stars, all the one you love.
We're busting out, right? We're going to start the show off with Eric B and Rakim. Follow the leader.
The irony was Public Enemy was performing at Nassau Coliseum, and that's where the opening one of the things is. And it's, I laugh. DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, Will Smith, he was there on the show.
I'm DJ Jazzy Jeff.
And yo, I'm the Prince.
And I'm Ready Rock C.
Hold up, bust this. We want to let everybody know where it's at. It's right here. Yo, MTV Raps.
On that Def Jam tour. And I was there and I watched him shoot it. And I was like, okay, this is cool. This is cool. And then I saw it and I said, wow. First of all, I didn't believe that was ever going to air.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the cameras. I saw what he was doing. I said, this is never going to air. Never, ever. Too many black people in one place. Never going to air on MTV. Not like that. Not unless it's a riot. Not going to happen.
Yeah.
So I go home, just like anybody else, and click on the TV on MTV. And I go, oh, shoot. Oh, shoot. I remember that. Oh, shoot. But I knew everybody. So it's like, wow, that's cool. That's really cool. So Peter calls me. He says, hey, man, did you see it? I said, yeah. He said, what'd you think? I said, that was cool. And I'm, you know, starting now, stick my chest out. Yeah, so what you want? He said, yeah, we just got Fab Five Freddy to be the host. I want you to check out what he's doing and let me know what you think. I'm like, are you fucking kidding? You want me to, whatever. You know, because I'm cool with Pete. I said, no problem. So I watched a few episodes with Fab and I said, oh, okay, this is cool. And they're showing videos. I'm like, oh, wow, there's a video for that? I mean, because remember at that time, it was Carlos DeJesus and Hot Tracks on a Saturday.
And now, here's your video host, Carlos DeJesus.
Hello and welcome to New York Hot Tracks. I'm Carlos De Jesus, and this week we're at the Plaza Suite in Brooklyn, New York. And if it's hot videos that you want, then you come to the right place. New York Hot Tracks, we have brand new videos for you from Rick James, Whitney Houston, and Billy Ocean. And of course, this year's hottest lady of them all, Tina Turner. She's had smash hit records.
That was like video Amazicano, and that was before Video Music Box and all that stuff. So it's like, wow, okay, this is cool, this is cool. And he calls me in and he goes, man, Yo MTV Raps is blowing up. He said, could you come in? I'm like, Pete, I'm not really a wealthy guy running back and forth to Midtown Manhattan, you know, to talk to you about what you think, what I think. So he says, no, I'm going to come work for a while. And I go in and he says, you know, with the success, he says, what do you think about Fab Five's show? And I said, I think it's all right. I said, it needs a little comedy to it, something, you know, something, a different piece in it to keep the audience's interest. Mm-hmm. He said, well, so what do you think you can do? I said, well, I could produce something because T-Money had gone to school for television and television production, and he understood it. I understood. I like watching television.
Right. you're a bit of a television historian from what I understand.
I'm a little aficionado on a few things. So I said, yeah, I can come up with some stuff, not knowing what I'm doing. Yeah, we'll come up with something. Give me Saturday. I'll have something set up for you. So we came up with this bit about doing haircuts at the barbershop. And I forgot. I always forget who was supposed to go in and do it. We had a friend of ours who had a lot of hair. So when they would cut it, we can cut from both sides. So Pete comes out. We go to the barbershop. We're sitting there talking for an hour now. He's like, yo, so when we get this on, I said, I'm waiting for the dude. He's not showing up. He said, Dre, I can't sit out here all day. What are you going to do? I said, okay. I jump in the chair. I do all the parts because I helped write it. So I knew it. We shot it. Got it done. Pete grabs the tape. Pew! Back to New York. Where's my tape? Where you going? Yeah, this is great. This is funny. I love it. Calls me on the phone about a couple days later. Dre, can you come? I said, don't tell me to come in there again. I said, Pete, you got to pay me. And he says, come on now. Come on in. I go in. Sits down. He goes, yo, I played the tape. Everybody loves it. They think you're great. I said, no, Pete, I'm producing. I'm on the producer side. I want to produce stuff. I wasn't imagining trying to be a host or anything of that nature. First of all, I'm black. Second of all, I'm a big black man. Third of all, I'm black. It's not going to happen. It's MTV. No. We love you, love you. Let me introduce you to my production assistant, Ted Demme. So Ted comes in. I go, oh, hey, how you doing? Nice to meet you. I go, Demme, what the... And I said to myself, I said, is he related to Jonathan Demme? Nah, it's too big of a coincidence.
Yo MTV Raps co-creator Ted Demme was, of course, the nephew of Jonathan Demme, the director of tons of movies, including Silence of the Lambs, Philadelphia, and Married to the Mob.
Introduces me, yeah, hey, man, yeah. I said, you did those Fab Five? I said, yeah, man, it's great. Fab's great, it's great. Okay. So Pete's telling me, yeah, man. So we're thinking about doing a daily thing. So remember, I had my chest pushed out the first time. I'm like, okay, so what do you want me to do? You want me to carry the water? You're going to give me an MTV jacket? What do I get, a sticker? What do I get for this?
Give you commentary every day on how you did. What do you want? Yeah.
He goes, no, we want you to go in and want you to host. I said, you want me to do what? Yeah, we're going to do it every day. We want you to go in and host. Okay, so I want you to go down to Ted's office, and Ted's going to shoot this little demo with you, and I'll let you know. Oh, all right, let me see. So I'm walking down the hall, and there's this other black guy sitting in the hall. Yeah, that's time on MTV. Seeing a black guy in MTV was like seeing a raisin and a vanilla ice cream cup. You know, that's super rare. Like, oh, crap, there's another raisin. How's that work out? And I'm looking at him. He looks at me, and I ignore it, and I go into Ted's office, and I sit down. Ted closes the door. Hey, man. So, you know, let's do this thing. We're going to make some stuff up, and you do it. And so I do it. And he's like, yeah, man, you're funny. You're good. Oh, this is so, yeah, Pete was right. I saw your tape. I said, can I get my tape back? He said, no, Judy's got it. Judy McGrath and Doug Herzog.
Judy McGrath began at MTV in 1981 as a copywriter and worked her way up to chairman and CEO of all of MTV Networks. She was named one of Forbes magazine's 100 most powerful women in 2009. McGrath is currently head of a joint venture with Sony called Astronauts Wanted, No Experience Necessary, and is on the board of directors of Amazon. Doug Herzog joined MTV in 1984 and was one of the channel's first executives. He eventually became president of all of Viacom, finally leaving the company in January of 2017.
I said, yeah, but can I get my take back? I ain't got my take. No, we'll give it back to you, but no, this is great. You're great. All right, going back to Pete's, I'll call you. Walk by, I see this guy, he's still sitting there. I walk out, he gets up, and he walks into Ted's thing. So I'm not thinking, oh, well, maybe, you know, that guy's auditioning too. I'm like, it's coincidence. Ted comes running down the hall. Hey, can I talk to you a second? I said, what? He said, I want you to introduce you to somebody, and I want you to come on back to my office. I go back to his office. Sorry, you got to drag it out. Story sounds funnier this way. Go back to Ted's office. We sit down there. hey, this is my friend, Ed Lover. Ed Lover, this is Dr. Dre. Dr. Ed, I said, oh, hey. He goes, yeah. I said, so what do you do? He said, yeah, you two guys, Ed, it's funny. This guy cracks me up. And you just cracked me up. I just met you and I love you. I think you're great. Could you two guys sit down? I want to see what you guys can do and see if there's a chemistry thing going on. About what? No. Just come on. Let's just try something. I said, okay, I'm game. So we see these reggae wigs, dreadlock, fake, and Ted's in his office hanging on a hook. So we grab and put them on and we do this Jamaican thing.
You look prosperous. You look healthy. I'm feeling like Strictly Business, man. They're good, man. Well, EPMD got a new album coming out at the end of the summer. So you make sure you go out and pick it up.
And everybody falls out. Ted jugs out, screaming, hollering, laughing. Grabs the tape, runs down the hall. Pew! I look at Ed, we put it back. I say, hey, man, nice meeting you. I think nothing of it. And I'm saying, why do they keep running down the hall with these tapes? What is going on? I go back to Pete's office. Pete and I are talking about, you know, stuff with the Beasties and music and stuff. And Ted comes running in. Dre, can I talk to you for a second? I said, sure. So he brings me back, sits me down with Ed. We sit down. And he goes, Judy loves you. Dougie thinks it's a great idea. Would you guys mind doing it together? And I'm looking at him, hey, man, I ain't that way. What are you talking about doing what together? He said, we want to do this show. We want to do it together. You two guys being the host. What do you think? And I said, do what? Yo MTV Raps every day. Oh, can I think about it for a second? Sure. Think about it and then come back and let me know. I mean, I want to go home and think about it. No. We want you to go out and come back in and let me have an answer. So I sat there and I went out and I talked to Pete. And Pete was talking about it. I said, no, Dre, if you want to do it by yourself, it's up to you. I said, you're going to, because Pete was the executive producer. Ted was the, you know, production assistant, becoming the producer of the show. And I said, no, I felt so many times as potential actors, hosts, or artists that you get together with somebody and you have a chemistry or something like that, and you become crabs in a barrel, and you think about just yourself. And I said, here's an opportunity for the first time on MTV to see something based on my radio, you know, my radio experiences and knowledges and my artist experience. Let me try to work with this guy. I don't know him from Adam Smith. I don't. So why not? I said, okay, let's try. Let's see what happens.
Very generous of you being that you had to split the money.
No, that's coming up. Huh. I didn't know that at first. But anyway, I felt I didn't know Ted, and I'm going into something which I realize again, and race does play a play in that, because you got to understand something. J.J. Johnson at the time wasn't the blackest man on the television screen.
Now, I'm J.J. Jackson, and I do have the music news for you here on MTV. And as a matter of fact, I recently went to Atlanta. In fact, recently, it was last week, and we talked with Boy George while we were down there about the new Culture Club video.
At the time, you know, original VJ host. But I understood where it was coming from. And I also understood, based on my experiences doing BAU and all the stuff that we did and PE doing what they were starting to do, I said, why not? And I remember calling Bill and calling Chuck and speaking to Hank, and they said, no, Drake, go for it. I said, okay, let's do it. And I remember the nervousness I felt, but then I also had the confidence because I knew what I was doing and I understood what I was doing. As we did the show, for the first time, we realized we didn't know it was a hit or anything. Our first guest on the show in that first week was Carole King.
The songwriter?
Yeah. And the artist, because we were at the MTV studio doing our first shows, because we shot everything in one day for the whole week.
Right.
And she was sitting on the bleachers looking at us and laughing. So we said, well, bring her on. And I recognized who she was. Ed kind of knew, because she started mentioning the songs. We said, come on. She said, but I'm not into rap music. I said, don't worry about it. It's okay. And she was our relief. That was the first guest on MTV Raps, Carole King.
Amazing.
Guest.
You guys had such an incredible variety of guests, and you know, we could be here all day going through them.
True.
But there were a few that I wanted to talk about and kind of see what they were like from your perspective, stuff that I think everyone remembers. And I think the most obvious one is Tupac talking about the Hughes brothers.
You're connected with Minister Society. We don't really want to go into what happened with your role in Minister Society right now, because this is not a Minister Society. We're not promoting Minister Society.
Let me tell the whole world.
All right, tell them how you did with
these chump, punk, slump, you know what I'm saying?
You'll have a chance to come here and rebuttal today.
No, they won't. They better come now. Check this out. They fired me, but did it in a roundabout punk snitch way. So I caught them on the streets and beat they behind. I was a menace to the Hughes brothers. And it ain't over. I still got more than chump.
Don't jump to the TV.
I'm gonna kick catch y'all in traffic and I'm gonna be the
Yes, it was. That was still, again, a momentary history thing that has happened never before in things where Ed put his hand over his mouth, told him, shut up, you could be prosecuted, you idiot.
And he was, as it turned out.
Yeah, yeah. They took the tape and subpoenaed it for what he was saying on the show. And it was like, dude, yeah, I know you're comfortable. I'm giving him the cutoff sign. And Ed's trying to put his hand on his mouth and he keeps going and going and going. But that's your own TV raps. That's what it was. Mm. And it honestly showed us, and the thing it worked, reason it worked so well with those kind of guests and all guests that came on the show from Bill Cosby. Yo!
Hi, I'm Bill Cosby, and this is MTV.
No, you're not.
Huh? Who am I?
James Brown.
Stay tuned to MTV Raps today. Blowing up.
Pam Grier. Mel Gibson.
Do me a favor, fellas. Just put the funk to it, okay? And then kick it old school, all right? Bye now.
That was Mel Gibson. Mel Gibson.
Mike Tyson.
Mike Tyson.
Yo, MTV raps today. And we're cooling, maxing, chilling and icing. Chilling in a tree with my man Mike Tyson.
You know it.
The reason that all worked is because Yo, MTV Raps felt like home to everybody. Mm. Because we were as big a fans of the people being on the show as they were as being fans of us. And the biggest thing, one of my partners who works with me now, when our production company, he said the biggest thing he ever saw was when we were going up to Sirius XM Radio and I was leaving an interview, Billy Bob Thornton came out. And he goes, yo, Dr. Dre, damn, what's going on, man? And he goes, you know Billy Bob Thornton? I said, yeah, I met him out at a VMA one time. And he's like sitting there going, you know Billy Bob Thornton? I said, yeah. I've been doing this a couple of weeks. People do know me.
Yeah.
And I have to attribute that to doing Yo and the great thing Yo brought to the world. And that's what we're kind of missing now, is that Yo could heal things. Even though we were always taped, and it was one of the biggest arguments we used to have with MTV, is like, we should be live. But we were talking so much nonsense. That's when they came with that MTV Live show, and we gave it to, what's his name? And we always laugh about that. We always said we should be live, but that would mean we'd have to come in every day. But the bottom line was, we saw how Yo could heal things. We would go out and say stuff. We would go out and do things. We would go around the country. Because at first, our show was never designed to leave the studio.
Right.
But our popularity, and this is the thing that we learned as it went along, our popularity grew. But MTV at that time, remember at that time, in the early, late 80s, early 90s, wasn't in New York. It wasn't in Manhattan like that. It really wasn't. It was in Long Island. It wasn't in Queens. Ed lived in Queens and couldn't see the show.
Right.
He had to go someplace else to tape the show, to see the show. I'd go home and tape it and be like, okay, it's right here.
Right.
Because we always had him. We always had cable.
Oh, because there was that whole, like, call your local cable company.
I want my MTV.
Call your cable company and say, I want my MTV.
They didn't have it. They had WHT and some other thing where you hang out a satellite dish with your arm outside and hopefully you catch some channels. But MTV was big, but it wasn't as big as we thought it was. But then when Ed and I finally started going out and doing stuff, and I remember the first time we went out, I went to go to LA to do a show with Peter with the Beasties. And I'll never forget, we were out doing some shows and stuff like that. And then people started hollering and screaming. I thought it was for them.
Right.
It was for me. Yo, Dr. Dre, yo. And I was like, yo, what's up? And they were like, you know how big that thing you're doing is? Because in California at the time, it was everywhere. Mm. In Oakland, Yo MTV Raps was everywhere. If they hung, you know, they do appointment television. That was appointment television like crazy. Then MTV got the wise idea, well, kill the show. We'll play it twice a day. It went crazy. And that goes back to my point. When every year we did Yo, every summer, we always thought it was a summer job. You know, we filled out, got the job in May, come August, September, we're done. Mm-hmm. And every time we got past the September, October, we were like, whew, we'll see. So when they came to give us our first contract, they said, well, we can't afford to pay you each separately what you should get, so we'll split the salary down the middle. And that's what we did. We said, okay, we'll take that chance.
Right.
We'll see how it goes. And the show became something we didn't even understand. Like I said, once we started getting outside and seeing all the reach of Yo MTV Raps, that's how Yo Mailman came to be, and that's how I bought T-Money on the show. Mm-hmm. Because we started saying, yay, write us here on MTV and so-and-so. And then the mail started coming in, and the mail started coming in from all over the world. It didn't come in just from Georgia. It didn't come in just from Detroit. It didn't come in just from L.A. It came in from France. It came in from countries in Africa. It came in from England. It came in from Japan. And we were sitting there going, whoa. And then we start to understand what Yo MTV Raps actually meant.
I wanted to ask about one particular episode of Yo beyond any of the guests, which kind of gets into some of the response to it on the network side, which is the Shut Up episode, where you and Ed were literally gagged the whole episode. And I think one of your producers took over in front of the camera until the very end.
The Shut Up episode was a result of MTV being asked to have Ed and Dre tone it down.
Ed and Dre have been very, very naughty Yo boys. And I'm here to apologize for any past remarks they may have said.
We decided that day when we went on, Ed and Dre weren't going to say a thing. They were going to be gagged.
I'd like to apologize to everybody in the whole entire world who Ed and Dre has dissed for some reason or the other.
Finally, at the very end, they had had enough.
Look, this is Ed Lover. We don't apologize to nobody. We ain't sorry. We don't care. Rap City is blah. Prime is blah. Everybody apologize to blah.
Their response to that was that you can't.
Ted did that.
Mm-hmm.
We were gagged as a joke because of we were starting to understand our outreach. As I was saying earlier, we discovered not even so much just the power, but the understanding of how influential what we did mattered around the world.
Yeah.
So we made a joke about that, and we were like, no, we're going to fight against this. We'll fight against this. And Ted said, no, guys, let's stay fun. No, this is fun. This is about our people. It's about our culture. And that's when they jumped us, and then they gagged us, and that was the show. But the fun part about doing that show, Ice-T did a show with us like that, where he kidnapped us, and he ended up hosting the show. And people were like, wow. And he tied Ed and I up and threw us on the couch. That's what being a fan about being able to do what you do. When I watch other hosts that do stuff now or other shows, watch here, it's understanding your vulnerability, but also understanding it's about the fans and it's about the artists. That's the show.
Yeah.
And the artists, we wanted to always have the artists come on and be themselves inside the show. So, yeah, you were this great rapper. That's what I said. One of the biggest fights ever was Chuck and I on the set doing snapping back and forth with each other. People are like, what are you doing? You can't talk to Chuck D like that. How dare you? And then Flavor would come on, and Flavor and I would go out, and people would lose their mind. And then Ed would jump in it because Ed didn't understand the dynamic of it. Mm-hmm. And then he did get it. He was like, oh, Dre and Flavor do this all the time. Yeah, we talk about each other's mothers, fathers, uncles, cousins, and each other like this. But we're like brothers
right. That
love each other. And I just saw Flavor at this show down in Philadelphia earlier this year at the Dell Center. And I hadn't seen Flavor in maybe almost 8-9 years last time I saw him. And his mother had passed, and he got together with me, and we hugged. And my sister Heidi was in the room, and a bunch of other people chucking him. And the room got silent because of the way we were hugging, and we wouldn't let go. And he's like, I love you, man. I love you. He said, do you ever believe? I'm telling you. I said, would you ever believe this would happen? We were talking about this at White Castle's freaking drive, you know, in the driveway. And look at this craziness. And we're hugging each other, and they're all sitting around blubbering and crying.
Right.
Now, understand it. That's how long we've been doing this. That's how influential we understood what we were doing.
Right.
Because it wasn't by chance Public Enemy became what it did. It wasn't by chance me, Dr. Dre, became what it was. We actually trained for this, unknowingly trained for it.
Right.
I understand what Alan Freed felt like. I understand what Dick Clark felt like. I really do. I understand what Don Cornelius felt like. We took a stone and we threw it into the forest, didn't know what would happen.
Hmm.
All of a sudden, trees fell, grass got cut, buildings went up.
Amazing. I was looking at some old episodes, you know, obviously, to prepare for this. And one of the things that grabbed me was the couple episodes you guys did, you and Ed did with MC Hammer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were funny. You seemed to have a, you know, legitimate rapport with him.
And I remember sitting at the New Music Seminar with you at the Marriott,
yep,
talking,
saying,
you know, how we gonna try to get in here and get it done, you know?
Mm-hmm. Next thing you know, there's a million, 20 million every day.
You know.
Large, explosion, Hammer, all that, and Lover
Yo,
the
Yo, MTV Rap.
Incredible. Incredible.
But it was at a time when, at least among rappers and a lot of fans, he was, you know, while selling a lot of records, there were also a lot of people who disliked him and who saw him as kind of the epitome of, you know, selling out and crossing over and so forth.
Dancing for popcorn chicken for KFC.
Last night, yes. Russ Beeler, owner of Lake Edna KFC, opened Hammer's eyes to new popcorn chicken. Delicious, crispy, bite-sized morsels. A whole new way to enjoy the Colonel's chicken.
Come on, Hammer.
The problem was, no one could get him to go on. until the last piece was gone.
Now that's pop.
New KFC popcorn chicken.
Go ahead, one stand.
Yeah, and so did you ever get any pushback for the series of episodes you had with
all day long.
With Hammer?
All day long. And then the business kicked in. The real business kicked in. And the appreciation for what Hammer did. And I always say this, Hammer was our greatest guide out of being rappers on the street alone. He brought us into the financial business world and said, what you're doing has a value, a real value, not just the jump on the stage, grab your nuts, and I'm the baddest in the world. Value. Hammer also said, I'm going to give you a show rather than you guys just walk back and forth and say, throw your hands in the air and collect money from people. I'm going to go out there, I'm going to dance, I'm going to sing, I'm going to do what I do, I'm going to bring out my people, and we're going to have a full show, and I'm going to show you what this should be, and I'm going to bring it to a different level. While you're doing stuff like that, amongst everybody that tries to, quote, unquote, to keep it real generation, you don't realize how far he's pushing the envelope the other way, and he's bringing something different to what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Because now, today, you can't get anybody not to want to be what Hammer did.
Right.
But back then, everyone treated rap music like it was their own. That's what Yo did. Remember I said, Yo was like a house and everybody wanted to stay. It was like a great hotel, bigger than the Marriott, bigger than the Hilton. It was like, I got to check in there. Them dudes are having fun.
Yeah.
But they real. And then here comes Hammer with a new hotel and him saying, yeah, keep it real, but guys, we can also do this. And all of a sudden, there was this challenge. But the challenge wasn't really Hammer. The challenge was Vanilla Ice.
How do you mean?
Because Hammer was doing what we always did, but we disagreed with it. But then when Vanilla Ice came out and we were like, wow, here's this white boy doing what this brother did, and he's actually almost outselling him. And then he did, or no, he didn't. By a million, I think Hammer beat him with that. And it was like, because MTV came to us and said, I love this Vanilla Ice kid. Look at this kid. And we were like, huh? No. What about third base?
Mm-hmm.
What about, different other rappers? No, this guy's not real. This guy's just doing this. And we weren't realizing that rap music was now becoming hip hop. And it was a broader music and a broader structure and a broader reach in MTV. And we felt that was going to be the downfall. And it was of Yo MTV Raps. Because MTV no longer needed us. This was Pariah, Eminem, and anybody else like that, because there were other white guys rapping. I mean, the Beastie Boys, I was a part of that, and I used to get jeered about that. Like, oh, look what you did. You brought these white boys in. I was like, no, they believe what they're doing. They're talking about their experiences, and people are clicking into it.
Right.
It's you got to understand something. Yo MTV Raps, rap music, was a savior to those who couldn't dribble a basketball or catch a football or hit a ball out of a baseball park. That's what Yo MTV Raps was. So it was your ticket out of being in your own area, or actually making you king of the block.
Mm-hmm.
And all you had to do was be able to put a couple of words together that rhymed rhythmically and put the beat of the day in, and bingo, you're now the star. So when you're bringing these other people in who have their own, you got rock and roll, why you got to come to our thing? Leave our shit alone. No, we want that same thing. Or to quote Flavor, we ride limos too.
You call them demos, but we ride limos too.
But we want to do it our way. And this is the only way we could protect it, because it was just a unique amount of people who were doing it. But as it became expansive, as a Yo MTV Raps presented the world with this music that we loved, and this being able to communicate with each other through rhythm and rhyme and dance, here comes Vanilla Ice. Here comes Eminem. Here comes all different people that came in. And young ladies, Tari B's, and all they were always out there. But now it wasn't a gimmick anymore. They were doing because this is what they felt. And that's what we got worried, like, yo, this is Hammer. You can't keep doing this because look what you're doing. Everybody's going to run through the door. But that was always the case. That's what Run DMC always say. Go for yours. We went for ours.
Oh. I want to talk about the movies for a second.
The movies.
Movies. Who's the man? We actually had, I don't even know if you would remember her, but a few weeks back, we talked to Martha Diaz, who at that time was Ted's assistant
yes.
on the set of Who's
I love
the
Martha
Man.
Diaz.
I had to make sure that Ted was all right because I was his assistant. Mm-hmm. And I had to make sure the artist showed up. So on one hand, I had one phone talking to artists. And the other phone, I was making sure the walkie-talkie, you know, Ted is not, you know, hollering, Martha! You know, so I was, that's how I was working. So
yeah. Still doing the film festival?
No, unfortunately, but she's doing a million other things.
Love her.
Yeah. So we heard her perspective on the set of Who's the Man, running around like a crazy person trying to wrangle talent and keep Ted happy. And what was making that movie like for you?
I give the greatest credit to that movie being made to our manager, Charles Stettler, because mm-hmm. he actually went out there with glue and tape, and he kept that movie going every day when it was supposed to be shut down so many times for various reasons. And we were blessed that he actually went out there and got it done. And we got to thank Jonathan Demme and Ted Demme, because Jonathan actually was supposed to direct it. And Ted was supposed to co-direct it at the time, because New Line didn't trust Ted as the first movie. Didn't want to trust him with it.
Right.
And Who's the Man was done and shot, story by Ed and I, on a shoestring budget. And to this day, I always look and say, that movie made a lot of money. Because it was one of the most heavily bootlegged movies before it was released, ever. I know I was sitting in my barbershop, and it was like, yo, Dre, did you see a movie? What? How did you get it? I saw it in my barbershop before I saw it on the opening screen. They had the tape with the edit thing going by. I'm like, damn. So I called Charlie, said, Charlie, the movie's there. And Charlie's screaming, Dre, I was on 25th Street. The movie's everywhere. What do we do? I said, nothing. I told you it was going to happen because it was that popular and that anticipated. It was a blessing. So the people Charlie assembled to work that movie, Mr. Fletcher, who was the AD, to Ted, you know, I remember when we wrapped up the last shot, because we were supposed to go, Ed and I were supposed to be in the movie called Philadelphia with Denzel Washington and Tom Hanks. I'll never forget that. We were supposed to go shoot two scenes with them. And we couldn't because there was a huge storm in New York and we missed a day of shooting. So we had to stay here to do it. But the day we were available to go shoot it with Tom and Denzel, we couldn't do it. So I'll never forget, because Jonathan never told us who he fudged in to take our place. He wanted us in there because he wanted a levity, some kind of bright funniness. And he said, you guys being in this, it would be bring us such a smile into the film. And we were like, yeah, we'll do it. Because we called him Uncle John. And then we shot our scene where we had to stay back. And we were hugging and crying. We were like, this is it. And I said, wow, what an experience. I said, we'll see what happens. And I said that at the end. I said, Ed, and I said, Charlie, I said, the only one who's going to benefit from this movie like this is going to be Ted Demme. He said, I have just a weird feeling. I said, this movie was such a labor of love for everyone that participated, all the super guest stars we had in it.
Who's the Man? A film directed by Ted Demme, starring Dr. Dre and Ed Lover, with Dennis Leary, Colin Quinn, and a who's who of hip-hop, including Naughty by Nature, Ice-T, Cypress Hill, Flava Flav, KRS-One, Heavy D, House of Pain, Salt and Pepper, Criss Cross, and Bushwick Bill.
Drop it! Oh, come on, fellas. You know the bad guys are gonna lose.
That's word up.
Everyone. And when it came out, and we got thumbs up from Siskel and Ebert.
Is a fresh, funny cop movie set in Harlem entitled Who's the Man? This is the kind of movie that seems to come out of nowhere with an energy and an originality that's obvious from the first frame. The film stars MTV co-hosts Ed Lover and Dr. Dre as characters named after themselves. They work in a barbershop giving the worst haircuts in town. Two thumbs up, though, for the fresh and funny Who's the Man? A comedy introducing the infectious talents of Ed Lover and Dr. Dre from MTV.
We just signed this big deal with Universal to start redoing the Abbott and Costello movies. And we were like, wow, we're really, and I cried, we're like, we're on our way. I just leased a house on Long Island because I didn't know where I was going to live. We could shoot at UMT Raps from anywhere. But we were debating whether we move out to LA so we could shoot stuff, or wherever we're going to shoot in New York. And those were all those conversations at the time. And then the Rodney King verdict came in. How lucky were we that it came the weekend of the opening of Who's the Man?
And so a movie where you're playing cops.
It wasn't even a cop thing. We opened huge in New York, even though the movie was bootlegged ridiculously. Mm. I remember going to three theaters, Roosevelt Field, where I grew up, and packed theater house. I remember going to Elmont to the Green Acres Mall and watched it, standing in the back, just to see people's reaction. People loved it. Going home and watching the riots in L.A., no one went. No one came. They were rioting. It's a little difficult to go to a movie when you're rioting and you're burning stuff down and you're beating people up in the middle of the street.
Right.
Hard to open a movie. So New Line, and I guess everybody else judges said, you know, Ed and Dre are just East Coast guys. They're not really universally, you know, popular like that. And it was a lie because Who's the Man to this day is shown all over the place. I still get that little check every once in a while. I go, oh, look, I can pay a light bill. Just was. And it was weird. Not even call it weird luck. To this day, I remember we were trying to get the rights to do Who Too. We'd come up with the screen and the idea of what to do with it. And people were kind of getting excited. We were getting people back, you know, wanting to be in it. And Mike DeLuca and New Line wouldn't give us the right to do it. Melvin Van Peebles went and said he'd give you $1 million for them to have the rights to pick up Who's the Man. That's how popular it was. And that had to be almost a decade later. Decade later. Couldn't get anything done. So while shooting that movie and shooting your own TV raps, and the blessing of all those people that did help us do it, it kind of was an insult to me when I went to see this movie recently that was released called Straight Outta Compton, which I call it Straight Outta Fiction. And they act like we didn't exist. I go, how could that be? Because if it wasn't for me.
No America's Most Wanted, for one thing. Is,
that's number one. No America's Most Wanted.
Dre is the one who introduced Ice Cube to the Bomb Squad, the Public Enemy affiliated production crew that would produce Cube's classic solo debut, America's Most Wanted.
Ice Cube's back on the set.
Don't try to apprehend him.
Ice Cube with the lynch mob. I got it going on. A nigga that's living in the city of the criminal zone. One time.
Number two, when we sat in that meeting and they said, hey Dre, there's this other guy out there calling himself Dr. Dre. Should we play this video? Because if you say no, it's no. I said, no, don't do that. I knew of this guy. I knew him when he was in the world-class wrecking crew. I knew of him in this way. And I even had a little correspondence back and forth with him. Play it. That was called Express Yourself.
I'm expressing with my full capabilities. And now I'm living in correctional facilities. Because some don't agree with how I do this. I get straight and meditate like a Buddhist. I'm dropping flavor.
How funny is that? How funny is that?
I was going to actually ask about that a little bit. When did you first become aware of Andre Young, you know, the West Coast Dr. Dre?
I knew of him when I was recording original concept album.
Mm-hmm.
Because the irony of it is, the guy who actually did a lot of work with him on the Chronic album grew up in Westbury, Long Island with me. His name was Greg Royal. If you look on the back of the Chronic album, his name is all over the place.
One, two, three into the four. Snoop Doggy Dogg and Dr. Dre is at the door. Ready to make it.
Greg Ski Royal is a producer, engineer, and mixer who, in addition to his work with R&B and pop acts like Paul Abdul and Guy, worked with West Coast hip-hop artists like Dr. Dre, RBX, and South Central Cartel.
That's why when he started using certain music, I said, how the hell would he know? Because they weren't using that. They weren't doing that. Greg Royal. That came from where I grew up. We was using the same songs. I said, damn. Wow. And then I called Greg, and I said, Greg, what's up with that? And he said, yeah, man, I got paid. I do what I got to do. I said, yeah, I kind of figured it out. I read your name and I said, this can't be the same Greg Royal. And it was, because he worked at K-Day with Greg Mack. So a little story about how they got the records on the radio. Greg told me the other side of it, that they couldn't get the records played on the radio because they were cursing every other second. So it's very difficult to play the songs.
Mm-hmm.
And they refused to do clean edits. But it was a street thing. And you know what? I applauded them for what they did, for how they did it and what they did. But I take my son to see your movie to applaud your story. And I didn't ask you to sit there and say, oh, yeah, and there was the other Dr. Dre. And no, I didn't ask that. I said, give credit to the show that made you who you were.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a radio station. It was your own TV raps. Should have played more prominently in the movie when you're going to tell the story of your life and how things happened. Because the scene when they're in Detroit and they get rushed off the stage, I was on stage with Ed when the cops did what they did because they decided to do F the police. And we're told and warned not to do it.
To the punk ass cop backstage. Yo, Dre.
What up?
I got something to say.
Fuck the police coming straight from the underground. A young nigga got it bad because I'm brown.
And they ran back to the hotel because the cops came after them. And I got stuck because they thought I was Dre. It's funny, same thing happened to me on my Facebook page recently with Surviving Compton and Michelle A telling her story. Mm-hmm. People are going, I can't believe you beat up Michelle A. I said, no, that wasn't me. It wasn't me. I'm sorry. Look at the pictures. It's not the same guy.
please, I'm not. No, I never touched. I know Michelle. I've seen Michelle. I talked to Michelle. I've done stuff. Yet, no, that wasn't me. But that's what happens. That's the name of the game. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's time to tell my story. Since you want to tell that kind of story, just like you said about the Ice Cube thing. Yeah, Ice Cube came to the city, Yo MTV Raps. Walked up to me and said, hey, man, could you get in contact with Chuck with me because I'm leaving the group? And I said, why? He said, yeah, I'm not getting paid. And this and the other. And I said, yo, okay, dude, here's my number. I'll give you a call. Let me reach out. I reached out to them. They said, cool. I picked up he and his fiance at the time, or girlfriend, whatever you want to say, now his wife, got into my Jeep with Keith Shockley, and I drove them back to 510 South Franklin, where PE was.
Right.
Where it all began. Bomb Squad. I was there when they started all that stuff. So when you make a movie and you put this image up showing things, I didn't ask you to entitle me to your success. Not at all. I'm very proud of what you've done. Mm-hmm. I see Ice Cube now. I give him a hug, kiss on the cheek, say, man, great work. But when I watch a movie like Ray and I know the backstory of that, and I talked to Taylor Hackford, and I talked to Ray Charles before he passed away, and I talked to Jamie Foxx and how it was done and why it was done a certain way. And matter of fact, I've even started talking to some people who produced that movie, and they said the same thing to them. Said, how could you omit Dr. Dre and their lover? And that's how you guys became what you did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Fab Five Freddy was the one who went on the road with you, but everybody came to Dre and Ed because everybody watched Dre and Ed for 5 days.
Right.
We went out there and shot that pool party where y'all had the girls running naked everywhere. I had those tapes. That was us.
Yeah.
You were on Yo MTV Raps daily more times than you were on Fab Show. You went out to Fab Show one time. We were out there because we were back and forth to L.A. And when we go to L.A., yo, Dre, come on, man, hang out with us. Come on, let's do this. No problem. We'll shoot it.
Yo, we at Compton Swap Meet where he's NWA ATL. That's above the law.
Word up.
Michelle A's around here somewhere, and the DOC is around here somewhere. And we all over here discussing underwear. Underwear is the topic. Since they always wear black, I was just wondering, Ice Cube, do you also wear black underwear?
Those are very important questions.
Yes. That's a very important question that people want to know.
Yo, now, why do you wear black underwear? Is that the high blue stain? No, man.
So you make a movie and you act like I don't exist? So when you ask me what do I think about him and what happened, I don't think anything about him. I mean, congratulations. God bless.
Mm-hmm.
God bless.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
Well, I wanted to kind of get into what's going on with you now. There was, you know, obviously a New York Times story a few months ago that, you know, got some renewed attention. I think surprised a lot of people talking about some of your health struggles over the past few years
mm-hmm.
as a result of diabetes. When did you first discover you had diabetes? Let's start with that.
The mid 2000s, like 2006, 2007,
mm-hmm.
around then, I was working for ESPN2 doing a show called Cold Pizza. I was doing DVD reviews and movie reviews. Again, when I usually go into a situation, they give me one job. They say, Dre, we need you to sweep up and clean up and stuff like that. And by the end of the year, I'm just saying, okay, how many guys like I had came in and I'm running the show? It just works out that way. Because I understand I let my personality do what it does. So I was going everywhere. I was doing big movies like iRobot with Will Smith and interviewing not only Saul, because people knew me. I was doing The Bourne Identity and The Bourne Supremacy with Matt Damon. That's how we became close friends and went to baseball games together, and Ben Affleck. And while doing all that craziness, I would go to a movie theater. They give you your popcorn. They give you a soda.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they don't give you like a cup of soda like this. They give you a giant soda.
What is it? Tub of soda, yeah.
Excuse me, Dr. Dre, would you like to plug into the machine and we'll just keep giving you soda till you're finished? Oh, thank you, man. Have the hose, please. You know,
yeah.
That kind of fun stuff. And I kept drinking that soda like that, like crazy. And I was running around and my lifestyle wasn't, eat the best, eat what you can and keep going, because that's what I was doing. And eventually it just caught up to me. It caught up with all that caught up to me, and I got sick with it. And I learned a lot. I knew a lot. And even to this day, I get yelled at a lot about stuff, but I understand what to do better now than when I did back then.
Mm-hmm.
I don't drink soda at all anymore. I think I'm like a water fountain, water fountain, or water tower now, more than anything else. And I'm more a little aware of what I have to eat and what I have to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I reached out to Dick Gregory, who I reached out to when I was first starting Yo MTV Raps, who wanted to help me back then. And I couldn't do it because I couldn't take the 6 weeks off to go to the Bahamas with Dick. Imagine going to MTV, I would like to take a 6 week sabbatical to go with Dick Gregory to the Bahamas so that I could lose weight. What?
Right.
What?
And then I'll start your job.
They were like, yeah, I would have lost my job. And yeah. I was trying to explain things. He's like, no, man, come on. We could do this, Dre. We'll make this thing. I said, Dick, I will not be able to come back here and be employed. You're going to continue to keep doing. You're doing really well with the shake. I will be out in the corner without a shake.
Yeah.
So I reached back to him. And like I told you the funny story a little bit ago about Dick Gregory and myself. And he's put me on a path to talk to some other people. And I recently talked to a gentleman named Dr. B, who does the holistic herbal side of everything. And we were talking and he goes, I know you. I said, yeah. And he starts telling me, I said, yeah, I know. That was you. And he says, yeah. He said, man. So I have a conference call with him later today. And we're going to work something out, because my goal is to, I start a foundation called the Dr. A Foundation for the Cure. I want to cure these diseases that are out here. There's no reason to keep treating it. That's like a fake game we're playing with each other. We keep saying, oh, we got another new treatment. Oh, we got another new this. And I got inspired, especially after Muhammad Ali passed away, because he's like one of my, you know, greatest heroes in my life. Because I've met him 3 times in my life. Once as a youngster, again as an adult. And then I met him in my latter part of my radio years. And always was fascinated with the man, because he was a man. He's the champ. He's not only just the people's champ, he's the champ. Most well-known person around the planet before Facebook.
Yeah.
Really was. And his aura in our conversation, and I always was stricken by how he really knew me. Not, oh, you know, yeah, I think I met you. I remember, yeah, yeah. No, he was coming to me and said, yeah, I remember when you was at so-and-so and so. Because I remember when he first came out to where I grew up in Westbury, Long Island, Newcastle, really, on Prospect Avenue. And he went to the Gazzura Youth Center at the time. We really called it Newcastle Center at the time. And the streets were flooded. And my father brought me in there. And I met him for the first time. And I shook his hand. And he was telling jokes and was laughing. I said, wow, this is the champ of the world. Holy shit, he's here. Then I met him again doing Yom TV Raps. And we were out, and his daughter was, Maymay was the head of the video. And we were like, yeah, so what's the deal? Is your father around? I was like, no disrespect to you, but, you know, your father is Muhammad Ali. It's like a, you know, it's not like
fair question. Asking, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, she said, no. He wants to meet you too. So he met N9. We basically, it was like one of those interviews where you sit there and you talk to my life. Mr. Ali, Muhammad, why you could call me Mr. Ali? You know, you guys make me laugh. And he's cracking up on what we do, and we're loving him. Because that's who you grew up. That's like a hero of yours. So long story short, I kept saying, wow, if he could do that and create a foundation for him with his Parkinson, I said, if I could do 1/10 of what that man did in his lifetime, I could die happy.
Yeah.
And then I also watched what Michael J. Fox did I grew up Michael J. Fox hero, just loving him. You know, he was Alex Keaton, so I always thought he was a great character. And then Back to the Future and all the other movies he did, like, wow, this guy. And then I watched when his Parkinson happened and what he was going through, and I saw a struggle, and I was like, wow, this guy is so strong. And then he was like, I remember I was watching an interview, I think he was on Letterman, and he said he'd gotten tired of, you know, raising money for this foundation, and he kept walking in and saying, so guys, where are we? And they kept saying, oh, Mike, it's okay. Thanks for the check. We'll let you know. And he said, that's it. No more of this. Michael J. Fox Foundation, I'll find the freaking cure.
We thought if we could start a foundation that would combine that level of advocacy with aggressive funding for research, that it would be a terrific thing and a new thing and add to those other great organizations that already exist.
What is it we don't know about this? Is it a disease, a disorder, a malady?
It's a drag.
Yeah.
Right.
And he was raising ridiculous amounts of money. And I heard, even to this day, every year he throws a dinner out here in Manhattan, and it's one of the most fruitful where they raise funds for his foundation. And I kept saying to myself, because I was approached by American Diabetes Association, who wants me to do some speeches. I said, sure. And some other people. And I said, you know what? I'm going to start my own foundation. And we're going to cure this thing. I said, not just the Dr. Dre Foundation and the blah, blah, blah. No, Dr. Dre Foundation for the Cure. First thing we're working on is diabetes. Second thing we're going to work on is other diseases out there that can be cured. Or we can educate people how to better their lives and how to make their health important. And I said, why am I being so one-dimensional? So we're going to work on economic cures. We're going to work on social cures. We're going to work on spiritual cures. Because rather than me running around and getting Al Sharpton and this person, and we start walking around and stop the protests. Let's get out there and really help people. I want to go out there next year sometime and go to Chicago and actually raise banners for peace. Because when Dwayne Wade's cousin was killed taking her children to register for school, and she's just killed doing that.
America really sat up and took notice over the weekend when a relative of the NBA superstar Dwayne Wade was shot dead in broad daylight in Chicago. She was pushing a baby stroller at the time. The case brought renewed.
We have a real epidemic problem that's bigger than just the nonsense the last election was talking about. So again, back to my Muhammad Ali analogy. If I can do anything in that vein with my quote-unquote celebrity and what I'm going through, because I've been touched by God, that's why I'm here doing what I'm doing. And he said, no, I have a lot more for you to do. Because I was on a teetering edge at one point. I was in a very bad, dark place. And I had made last rites with my family and my kids and said, hey, you know, I don't wake up. You know, don't make a big deal of this. Just, you know, cremate me and don't hold these funerals and memorials because fake people come and show up. I said, no, Dad, we can never do that. We have to. I said, no, you don't. And miraculously, as I said, I laid in my bed and God came to me. And I know people say that, but he does come to you. He does. In your weakest moment, in your darkest hour, when you think it ain't right, he's going to come and tell you what to do. And he told me what to do. So I'm going to do it. Dr. Dre Foundation for the Cure. That's number one. Number one. Number two is going to be the Dr. Dre Network, which is going to give opportunities to millions of people out there who want to do things in their entertainment world. If you want to sit there and play spoons and you can entertain people playing spoons, there you go. I mean, YouTube is great, but I'm going to do something which use the knowledge of my experience of years of being on television, film, radio, et cetera, music, and I'm going to do something a little different. Mm-hmm. I'm going to, again, what I've done from your MTV to Hot 97 Radio to Power 105 Radio, all over, everything that I've ever done, I've always changed the landscape. So I'm going to change the landscape again. But like I said, the Foundation for the Cure, that's very dear to my heart, not just because I have diabetes. I want it because there's so many people out there that if I can give you a doorway, give you an opportunity, and we can bring you along, and we can go from city to city to city to city to city to city and make it actually work, that's what I'm going to do.
And finally, any entertainment initiatives?
I just told you the Dr. Dre Network is the big initiative. Because when I got with Bilal, we were first thinking about trying to do a television show about this. We got so much resistance about it being just a health show. And I tried to use the tagline, it's Dr. Dre, Dr. Oz meets Dr. Dre, which it is. It's a multi-entertainment / educational / you name it. It's going to be on the show. And the best example I can give to you, I love the man for his talent, his musical genius, and his acting. But Harry Connick Jr. has a show, and I kind of like what he does, but I think I can do it better. And as Bill Adler said, it's going to be a lot of fun watching this blind motherfucker go out there and do a show. Every day, people are going to want to tune in to see, what the fuck is he going to do next?
Right.
And I'm going to do that, and I'm going to give people that. But I found out, you know what I'm good at? And this is where the BAU training came in. And even being a street DJ from the bottom up, I'm creative. And I'm very successful being creative. No, I didn't make $1 billion doing beats. I didn't do Straight Outta Compton. I didn't make that record that everybody's going to remember for the end of the day. But I think I did a couple of shows that people really think were pretty remarkable. So now let me do it again. And let me do it with the help of the world.
Oh, we can't wait to see it, Dr. Dre. Thank you so much for...
Thank you.
Appearing on the show.
Thank you so much.
Like a lot of people who didn't grow up in New York City, perhaps my biggest window into hip-hop during my years growing up in the 1980s and 90s was Yo MTV Raps. So I really loved being able to talk to a key player in that show and find out how it worked. But Dre, as you just heard, has done so much more than just host a show on MTV. He was pretty much everywhere you'd want to be during the key early years of hip-hop, and we are so lucky to get to hear him talk about it. And we should all be so lucky as to be cursed out by Dick Gregory. Join us next week when our guest will be Raskas. We'll talk to the C. Arson Rhymer about his long and storied career, as well as his latest album, Intellectual Property. You won't want to miss this one. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Once you do that, you'll be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, make sure to listen to our interview with the Bomb Squad's Keith Shockley on episode 156. If you use iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating and a review. It helps us bring more fans and attention to the show. Also consider helping us out by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a show every single week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh, and we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output.
If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just a dollar a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus material that comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. Become a patron by the end of January to get access to the file. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotaro.
Are you high?
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross.
He left me in the Bronx one time. He left me in Brooklyn one time.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
He just was always the Irish guy drunk hanging out with us.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Right here, this young man, he's a genius.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Terry Ryan.
Oh, look, I can pay a light bill.
Extra special thanks to Bill Adler for making this interview happen.
I like women. They may teach me something I don't know.
And another special thanks to Letterman superfan and archivist Don the Don's Giller for helping us find the Michael J. Fox clip from 2000.
Wow. He's my hero.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
It's a beautiful thing for me. I think there's a protest going on.
If only.
Oh, there will be.
Oh, no, I know.
There will be. We have no idea what we just got ourselves into.